to warn you, this episode contains descriptions of domestic abuse, violence, and sexual assault.
I'm Nick Wallace. This is reporting Depp v. Heard. Regular updates from the court in the celebrity trial of the century.
Hello and welcome to week four, day two, or day 14 of reporting Depp v. Heard. We are outside Fairfax County Court, as you can see, and behind me, for reasons that I really don't quite yet understand, I've got a documentary film crew maker. Give us a little wave. There you go. And he does, and he keeps the camera steady. What a pro. So today was an interesting day. The queue was down on yesterday, but still very busy. I managed to get into court and also managed to fulfil some duties for my visa sponsor, Channel 5 News, who are taking a renewed interest in this case simply because we're not far away from seeing Amber Heard take the stand. But she didn't do that yesterday. However, we got the first of her witnesses, but not before something very dramatic happened. I'm not going to take you through it myself because I have a rather superb park bench guest, Liz, who attended court for the first time today. She's been a podcast listener since we started putting them out before the trial, and decided that, having listened to enough of this, she was going to come and see what it was like to be in court herself. She queued up and got into the main court, and these are her reflections on the day.
So there's actually a couple of reasons why I'm here. The first one being that I have been following this trial for the entire time it's been going on. From my phone, at work, at home, in the car, just absorbing it all. And in the days where I wasn't able to watch as much, I looked for a podcast about it. And yours was the only one that came up. I know. And I really liked the way you came at it. And I was like, you know what? I want to go see what it's all about. So I wanted to come and meet you and thank you in person.
Well, it's a genuine honor to have you on my park bench.
It's an honor to be on the park bench.
Yeah, I say my park bench. We're just sort of borrowing it from Fairfax County Court.
They don't mind.
They don't mind. I'm sure they don't mind. They haven't kicked us off yet. Let's just rattle through the last of the two Johnny Depp witnesses that we heard this morning. So we finished off with Aaron Filati, who was examined by Johnny Depp's side, and she listed a lot of the things that Amber Heard had reported to her, such as her substance abuse, her dysfunctional family growing up, and the conditions that she suffered from. And the one thing that stuck out for me was the cocaine abuse. She self-reported cocaine abuse, which we haven't heard much of. But it appears to have been a real problem for her at one stage. And so that's noteworthy as a journalist. You always look to that sort of thing. And then the second chap, it was Mr. Spinkler, the forensic accountant, who gave a very short presentation.
Oh, yes, it was short and actually very lively for what it was.
He'd be enjoying himself, didn't he? But his basic point was that Johnny Depp had lost £40 million worth of opportunities, £22.5 million of which was Pirates 6, as a result of the op-ed. And then when he was cross-examined, the cross-examination said, well, you didn't actually link it to the op-ed, you just calculated that this is how much money he'd lost. And he was kind of like, yeah. So I'm not quite sure what the point of it was. How did you read it?
So as I have with a lot of the things that have happened in cross-examinations from the Depp witnesses, I read it as Ben Rottenborn doing what Ben Rottenborn does best and getting that clickbait, that soundbite that the American media is so fond of.
Right.
And then just cancelling everything out.
Actually, well, this takes us on to the move to strike. So there was drama.
Oh, my God.
Was this just before lunch?
Just before lunch.
So go on, explain what happened.
So there had been some speculation this morning while we were all in queue saying we think they're going to move to strike today. In American courts, that's not totally uncommon before the second half gets presented.
Explain it for a British viewer. What is a move to strike?
Basically, it says they have not presented the plaintiff in this case, the accuser, has not created enough evidence in the testimony presented thus far to say for sure that their side is correct and...
Or even has a case.
Right.
Yeah. So therefore, we, the defense, want you basically to throw this case
throw
out
this whole
before
thing out.
We have to present a defense.
Yeah, because why should we have to present a defense if we have nothing to defend against? But I believe, based on the information that I have seen over the last several weeks, there's plenty of evidence there for Johnny Depp's case that says, no, we have evidence here. And they were basing it, because the whole case is based on one thing and one thing alone. It's the op-ed. And the op-ed, according to Rottenborn, and there's three very distinct points of the op-ed that are being contested here. So Rottenborn gets up and tries to explain it away and say, this is blah, 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 and move to strike, and this is not going anywhere, in his Ben Rottenborn fashion. And in the middle of it, Chews gets up and he's like, I can argue now, can I?
It was really interesting actually seeing Ben Chew in full flow, because we haven't really seen that yet.
I loved it.
And he went on a rhetorical flourish that made his point very eloquently. But I think, I mean, the point about move to strike is it's chancing your arm a little bit, isn't
it? Absolutely.
Because for a judge to say, no, I am not going to let a jury decide this case, there has to be pretty overwhelming evidence, I would say, for a judge to go, right, that's the path I'm going to take. And she said she was going to have to take advice on it, but I don't think there's any doubt that this is now going to roll on, because we've now started Amber Heard's evidence. Not Amber Heard herself, her choice of witnesses. And the first witness was a forensic psychologist.
Another one.
Another forensic psychologist, Dr. Dawn Hughes. And Dr. Dawn Hughes, amazingly, came up with a diagnosis and a conclusion about this case, and about specifically about Amber Heard, that exactly matched what Amber Heard wanted her to conclude.
Exactly.
In exactly the same way that Dr. Shannon Curry, 8 days ago, came up with exactly the same diagnosis that Johnny Depp wanted her to conclude. I thought she was very fluent. I thought she was very engaging in the same way that Shannon Curry was very engaging. But at the end of the day, they're still opinions, and they seem to be essentially opinions for hire. Would Dr. Hughes have been picked as a forensic psychologist for Amber Heard had she not come up with exactly the same conclusions that Amber Heard wanted her to?
And
it almost feels like something of a farce, because they cancel each other
out. It does. It's interesting, because there's a logical side of my brain going, which test did she take first? Did she go in for her examination with Curry first or with Hughes first? And I feel that would help me to better understand why these two results on these same tests were so vastly different.
I would love to get a forensic psychologist on the podcast or on my YouTube channel to explain to me how you can have two very well-respected, currently practicing forensic psychologists approved by the courts and licensed to practice can look at one person extensively and the same material and come to two diametrically opposite conclusions. I would love to, it's an open invitation for any forensic
psychologist. It's really easy to get on this park bench. You just show up at court, you find Nick.
There is no application process.
There really isn't. I happened to find him in the cafeteria and be like, hey man, you're pretty much the reason I'm here. Thank you for what you're doing. And he was like, you want to come be on the park?
Liz, I do appreciate you coming on and giving us your perspective.
Thank you for letting me come here, and thank you for doing what you're doing, because it's absolutely something we don't get in America. We don't get this unbiased, absolutely objective journalism anymore. And I, for one, am enjoying this breath of fresh air that you are.
My thanks there to Liz for the park bench interview. She isn't going to be around for a bit, but she hopes to come back after the break and maybe do one more day before the end of this trial. We've got 2 more weeks and 2 days to go. Before I disappear, I want to introduce you to a remote park bench interviewee. His name is John Davis. He is a semi-retired lawyer, and he's also a fervent supporter of the men's rights movement. And he was introduced to me by a mutual contact who is taking a very considerable interest in this case and thinks it could have all sorts of implications, partly depending on the result, but also just watching the narrative as it comes out into the media. And he recommended that I speak to John. And so yesterday I had a wee chat with John, and this is the result.
It's not straightforward because, as in many cases involving intimacy, much of the evidence is only within the minds of the two participants to the domestic violence or sexual assault, in this case, which Amber Heard has accused him of. So it's a matter of very carefully and meticulously putting together witnesses, which you've seen Johnny do for the last 10 days, that will be able to provide circumstantial evidence that's solid, that shows that there's a high probability that Johnny is telling the truth.
Before we start talking about the success or otherwise of both parties' strategies, tell me where this can end up, because the jury of 7 eventually are going to have to make a decision on both the claim and the counterclaim. What are the possible options for them?
Well, there are many. One, they can deny Johnny any relief and award Amber $100 million or more. It's really up to their discretion. In a state like Virginia, there's no limit on how much they can award as a jury.
So is the amount that each other is suing, each party is suing each other for, nominal? Because Johnny Depp's suing for around $50 million and Amber Heard's suing for around $75. Is that nominal? They could get more than that.
They could get more than that. I wouldn't say it was nominal, but that's more metaphorical. You know,
right.
That's about what Johnny's experts think he was damaged economically. Plus, they're asking for what we call exemplary or punitive damages. And that is where somebody does something so bad or evil that the jury decides they want to punish that person and causes them to pay more to compensate Johnny for his emotional troubles over this and his attorneys, or vice versa. They award it to Amber because they feel that Johnny has done something very wrong in the context of this whole scenario.
I understand, and I've spoken to enough women actually who say that they see this as showing that men can be victims, and that men, even powerful men relationships, can be victims, which is, I wouldn't say quite anathema, but it certainly goes against the grain of what we've been hearing. It's, you know, over the last 20, 30 years.
It goes against the stereotypes.
It goes against the stereotypes. Right. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one of the things that I've had to do is just understand that I may have come with a load of baggage to this story, which I thought were assumptions that were legitimate. But it turns out that many, many people who are following this trial and supporting Johnny Depp are wanting those assumptions challenged very, very strongly, because it's their lived experience.
The assumptions, yes. Whether Johnny or Amber wins or neither or both is not as important as the discussion in the public that this trial is sparking, that it's engaging among ordinary people who are for the first time seeing these stereotypes and cliches about domestic violence being perpetrated mostly by men, et cetera. That's just not true. And people,
when
are
you,
finally
when you say mostly, because that. I think percentage wise, that's a really important thing.
Mm-hmm.
You're not suggesting that women are the main perpetrators of domestic violence, are you?
Oh yes, there's a number of studies. You have to step away from the feminist research, because that's just at what they call advocacy research. It's not credible. In the last 15 years, there have been objective gender neutral studies done blind as to the gender of the participant parties. And in fact, women initiate 70% of domestic violence. Okay.
Right. But why is it that more women die at the hands of men than men die at the hands of women then? Because
men
is pretty incontrovertible, isn't it?
Yeah. Women are most likely to be harmed in domestic violence when they attack the man and he defends himself, okay? Because men are very capable of defending themselves. And a lot of so and so many men killed their wives last year. Well, yeah, and a lot of them, it was self-defense. If you think of a population of 365 million people in the United States, 30 men killing their wife and it being self-defense is not implausible. Okay, that's actually a reasonable number of men who kill in self-defense.
Now, how many women kill their partners in self-defense then?
If you take away the self-defense, the self-defense is a little different from something that we heard a lot about called abused woman syndrome, where they call it the woman snaps and claims that after years of abuse, she just decided to kill him. Okay. There have been several cases of those. As far as I know, none of those defenses have stood up on appeal.
It does sound to me like you are saying that women are more violent intimate partner relationships than men.
They are.
I'm really interested in the fact that you think this is a thing, this is really important, and you're turning conventional thinking on its head here. But we know that more than 90% of men are responsible for all violent crime, don't we?
Yes and no. If you make adjustments, most of that is organized crime activity, men killing each other. So if you take the remainder, men are not overly injurious of women, especially in terms of killing, especially if you add in children, because women kill three times as many children in the U.S. as they do, as men do, okay?
Right. In terms of
murders. So if you add in the children, women are about just as violent as men.
Let's take that as a starting point, that men are that women are just as violent as men. I'm not saying that I accept it, and I'm not saying that I'm an expert in this field, but let's take that as a starting point. What do we do about it?
Well, I think we need to make some honest inquiries into what causes violence in the family environment, and a lot of that goes back to our abandonment of efforts to try to treat people for especially depression. Men who are clinically depressed are biologically often driven to violence, and it's not rational. It's not a rational act. We have a lot of school shootings, for instance, are often white boys. Well, why? Well, because they have access to psychiatric medication and psychiatric treatment. It's not the medicine that causes the violence. It's abrupt changes or improper dosages that cause the violence. And there's very few incidents of it, but it hits the front pages when it does occur.
So is the message that men need help, not being castigated for what society perceives as their behavior?
Yeah, I've seen credible estimates like from the Innocent Project that close to 40% of the men currently in prison in the United States are simply mentally ill, and may have committed what could be criminal acts, but did not have the ability to defend themselves against the criminal justice system, and their violence or whatever they're incarcerated for could have been prevented with proper medical intervention. Well, I think the starting point is, first of all, piercing through all these false stereotypes about men being the violent gender. I think we need to recognize that it's a human condition and it's not gender specific. Anybody can be violent, women, men, children. And I think we need to take a look at it without trying to assess blame on people based on their demographics. It's not just Black men or white men or men. It's not just women or Black women or white women. We need to recognize that it's part of the human condition. And I think we have to make some enlightened efforts to apply neuroscience and psychiatry and recent developments in those fields to look for ways of helping people to prevent this violence, as opposed to simply punishing people when it occurs.
At the back of my mind, I'm thinking the whole time of how women are trained to fear men, that are worried about walking home on their own at night. And there aren't that many female rapists. You know what I mean?
Well, no, there aren't in terms of forcible rape, but there aren't that many male rapists either. You may find this hard to believe, but for instance, in the UK, you're only talking about, 180 convictions per year of violent rape. And the feminists in UK, for instance, will say, that's because the police are letting 65,000 rapists go. That's just not
true. They do hold up the lack of rape convictions compared to complaints as a sign of the failings of our society.
It is. The UK is particularly affected by the hysteria. As I said, they have five times the rate of rape complaints per 100,000 people as the United States. And a lot of that has to do with the British culture. British men and American men both are appalled by rape. They hate rape. Everybody does. Nobody wants to encourage or commit something called rape, except a few individuals. In terms of women being afraid, there's no doubt in my mind that the media is driving that fear to the point of hysteria. It's not justified. Yes, bad things happen. Certainly, we've all had bad things happen to us in life. That's part of life, and it's one of the risks that we encounter as human beings. But it doesn't mean that we have to live in fear, especially not of each other. A lot of the fear that women have toward men is the hatred of men generated by feminism that's reflecting back.
Feminism surely has achieved great things. It's got women out of being property of men. It's got women the vote. it's got a huge amount of equality for women. So I don't understand why the men's movement is so against feminism.
Well, everything you just said is not true when you look at history, okay? And that's very difficult for someone in the UK to even begin to comprehend. I'm somewhat of an expert on history of British law. It was part of my postdoctoral degrees in law. And if you look back, that's just not true that women were considered property. There may have been some editorials in newspapers that said something like that, but it's just not true.
So this concept of chattel didn't exist?
Yeah, no, it didn't. It really didn't. That's an invention of the feminists and actually goes back even to Roman law. It's a misinterpretation of Roman law and Roman customs, the concept of patriarchy, for instance.
John, I do appreciate talking to you. We've only got a very short amount of time left. Let's tie things up by going back to this trial.
Great.
What would a win for Johnny Depp mean for you?
I think the most important thing, I'm going to put aside the money. The money is a measure of what the jury might award, is a measure of how strong they believed Johnny. But I think a win for Johnny would say, yes, it's possible to challenge these lynch mobs that go after men simply based on accusations and the gossip in the media. Okay, that's the most important thing I think that would mean to me if Johnny prevailed.
And what if Amber Heard is telling the truth?
If Amber Heard is telling the truth, then I think we have a situation where, at the very worst, Johnny shows that men can be victims of domestic violence, and we need to start protecting men's interest in domestic situations as well as women's, and with equal fervor on both sides, for both genders.
So there we go, another episode of Reporting Depp v. Heard. My thanks to John and Liz for taking part. My thanks to you for sticking with us this far. Don't forget, if you want to support the written work that I do, which kind of funds the podcast and kind of funds the YouTube channel as well, all you have to do is go to reportingdeppvheard.net/newsletter. And for a one-time only donation, you can basically keep funding my journalism from court. I'm at court every single day. I'm getting into court where I can. I'm live tweeting where I can, and basically spending far more time in the Fairfax County Court cafeteria than my waistline would like me to. Thank you very much for sticking around. I will be back with another episode tomorrow. We're going to have more of the forensic psychologist, Dr. Dawn Hughes, this time under cross-examination, and we'll see where that takes us. But until then, goodbye.
I'm Nick Wallace. This is Reporting Depp v. Heard.